This is Fresh Air. We've all had fantasies of playing God at some time. Imagine what you would do if you had the chance. That's the plot of Robert Bausch's comic novel, Almighty Me. The main character, Charlie Wiggins, is a car salesman who one day receives notice that God's power has been bestowed upon him for 1 year. What follows is the story of Charlie's struggle with power and its limitations. Here's Robert Bausch reading from the opening of Almighty Me.
One cold night in November 3 years ago, I was a normal person opening his mail. I was a very normal person. It was November 7th, a Tuesday. I don't see any reason why I should try to be modest about this. I was a very kind, nice sort of person. I never harmed anyone on purpose. I tried to smile all the time at old people, and I was patient with other people's children. I paid my bills on time, contributed to the National Arbor Day Foundation, Greenpeace, and Jerry's Kids. I believed in God. But I was not who I am now. I did not think I would ever write this story, but at the end of that winter 3 years ago, the winter that began with that cold November evening when I first opened Chet's letter and discovered I had been awarded the power of God for 1 full year, no strings attached, I made a momentous decision which has required that I set down this narrative. At present, I see what I will write as the first step in a final attempt to break a terrible stalemate, a paralyzing standoff between myself and God. The decision I spoke of was the most significant of my whole life. In truth, it may be epical for just about everybody.
Where did this idea come from? This idea of having the power of God for a year. The power, but not the knowledge.
It began with a conversation I had with my brother-in-law, who's a poet. His name is Gregory Natt, and we go to Canada fishing every year. And we were sitting in this fishing camp, and, you know, as things will, when you're sitting around talking and smoking and drinking, the talk is fun, and it goes wide-ranging.
Yeah.
And at one point, I just happened to ask whether or not Christ trimmed his beard. It seemed to me that every picture I've ever seen, a representation I've seen of the Lord, his beard is perfectly trimmed, and he was, after all, God, and he did have the power to do anything he wanted. I mean, since he was God, he had to know that air conditioning was 2,000 years hence, and maybe on a real hot day in the desert, no one was around. Who would it have hurt if he just, you know, gave himself a little perk there? I mean, he was human, after all. And I didn't think it was irreverent to ask the question. I just wondered, why would he go through all that trouble of trimming his beard when he could very easily just sort of, when no one was looking, snap his fingers and it would be trimmed? And that got me thinking of what would happen if you gave an ordinary human being God's power and not his wisdom. What would he do?
And you picked a car salesman as the embodiment of at least God for a year on earth. Why a salesman?
Well,
or car salesman, actually.
I sold cars for a while when I got out of the service. I knew the business well. I wanted him to be somebody who was working with people every day. And I'm glad that he was turned out to be selling a big-ticket item. But I really discovered he was a car salesman while I was writing it. It wasn't anything I planned. I had to give him a job, and I was writing the sentence. And I wrote car salesman knowing, as every writer knows when he writes a sentence, that might change. But as I began to build on it, it became more and more solid, and then I just left it that way.
Well, I wonder, having never been a car saleswoman, whether there's something that a car salesman has to do. You have to be better than yourself. You have to be patient. You have to be long-suffering. You have to be all these good qualities to make the sale.
Mm-hmm. And you have to be friendly, and you have to be, you really do. I mean, I did it for a year, but I learned a lot in doing it. You really do have to begin to care about the people you're working with. I mean, the people can sense right away when a car salesman or any person they're working with really doesn't care about them and cares more about themselves. The salesmen who come on with the glitzy attitude and the greasy look don't succeed because they can't really care about the people they're dealing with.
But people know that, right?
Right. Yeah, they sense it. That's why people are scared when a car salesman comes up to them, because they're afraid they're going to have to make the commitment of caring about this person or seeing that this person doesn't care about them. It's not that they're afraid the salesman is going to somehow hypnotize them and make them buy a red car. It's that there's that relationship between a salesman and a person that people don't want unless they're certain they want to buy something, because they don't like to say no to somebody they come to like. And most of the salesmen I've known who were successful salesmen were really good people. Oh. They told great stories. They were funny. They were enlightened. They thought about a lot of things other than tickets and prices on cars.
Were you a good salesman, car salesman?
Yeah.
Did you have those qualities?
I was a young man then, and my father was a car salesman all his life, and I felt so proud of myself for doing something my father was so successful at. My father was a really good salesman. He had most of his friends were customers, people who bought cars from him. He made relationships with people work, and I was proud to be doing that. I didn't succeed to the point where I thought I could make a career out of it. I did learn a lot. People don't buy a car in a gloomy mood. Most people who buy cars, almost all the time, they're in a real good mood. And when you deliver a car, it's a real good experience. It's almost like what it must be like to perform weddings. I mean, that's a ceremony. People come to get a new car, they're real happy about that.
My guest is novelist Robert Bausch. His new book is called Almighty Me. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Robert Bausch is my guest. Do you think of yourself as a religious man?
I think of myself as a committed man.
Committed to what?
My work, my family. When I say my work, I mean my teaching. I think about moral questions a lot, about what's right and what's wrong, because I was raised Catholic, and Catholic upbringing is very clear about that. I mean, there's a good reason why priests and nuns wear black and white. The Catholic vision of the world, at least when I was growing up, was black and white. It's either good or it's not, and there wasn't really... The in-between they tried to give you was venial. They said this is venial, but they didn't know the difference between real evil and I don't know, their idea of what evil is. I mean, you know, when I was a boy, it was a mortal sin to eat meat on a Friday. To eat a piece of deviled ham on a Friday was just as bad as barbecuing a child. And that vision, when I was that age, I was incomprehensible to me. Even as a young boy, it didn't seem to me that those two things were equal.
Do you think having this kind of Catholic upbringing gave you a structure, at least to ponder some of these questions, whether in the end you believed them or you didn't believe them? But I most of the Catholics that I know carry, whether they still go to church, whether they still believe anything, they carry this Catholicism with them. It's impossible to shed it.
I'm not Catholic anymore, but my body is. You know, there's a part of my psyche that will never give that up. I mean, when I have a significant desire or anxiety... I do things to try to do what I call is charming the fates. But really what I'm doing is a significant form of Catholic prayer, is praying for guidance, asking for or hoping. You know, what are you doing when you're hoping? Right. You're speaking to something outside yourself. So there, intellectually, I find it sometimes very difficult to accept what I think is fairly selfish Christian notion about God being personally involved with me. And I, as a teacher, I've seen how that operates, and that seemed to me to be more selfish than people realize.
Well, I wondered, too, about the phrases people use with if they survive an accident, they say, thank God. And I wonder, then, reversing that, you look at, for instance, at what happens in Bangladesh or Ethiopia or Sudan, God has picked those people to kill them?
You know, the best example I can think of that is I had a class, a creative writing class, and I had a student who was writing a story about the miracle of the shoes. It was a true story. And unbeknownst to her, there was another student in the class who was working every day with me and with her counselors and with her priest and with everyone she knew to get her daughter to come to accept the fact that she was going to be dead within the year of leukemia. They were working with her and praying with her. And at the same time, she was praying to God to bring this young girl back. And these were sweet, good people. And this other woman was a very sweet, good woman, too, and she's turning in this story about praying to find her daughter's shoes on her first day of school and how really important it was and how the morning was all upset and turned over and everything was in disarray, and she looked in a closet and they weren't there. And then she knelt down and said this prayer to God, please help me find my daughter's shoes. And she found the shoes and thanked God, and she called that a miracle. And I kept looking at the woman whose daughter was dying and who was a good and faithful person who didn't deserve what was happening to her. And her daughter certainly didn't. Her daughter was only 6 years old. And her prayers every day not being answered, and this person talking about a miracle of shoes, seemed to me to be so profoundly selfish as to be not expressible. There was no way that she could understand how selfish it was and self-centered it was to think that God would intervene in her life to find those shoes and would leave this other woman's misery to herself. I like what my friend George Garrett says. He's a great writer, and one of the things he talks about, he's a very religious man, more religious than I am, and he says, God has never been very interested in persons. And I think that's true.
You have a twin brother,
right?
An identical twin brother?
Yes, looks exactly like me.
It looks so. You could have been your twin brother. You could have tricked me here and come here as your brother.
No, I wouldn't do that, although we have done that. We did that in high school.
Well, I was wondering whether, if you look exactly like somebody else, and people do confuse you with that other person, whether that ever gave you a kind of confused identity, if you were called by your brother's name a lot of the time, or half the time?
What it did is it made me want to establish at a very early age my identity and made me more conscious of it. I remember we were in the fifth grade. We were at a school called Weller Road Elementary School in Wheaton, Maryland, and they had, for some reason I've never explored, and maybe I should, they had probably 15 to 20 sets of twins at that one elementary school.
Really?
And so they wanted to do this thing at an assembly and have us all sing Me and My Shadow. And I remember rehearsing that and turning to my brother and saying, I don't know about you, but I'm not anybody's damn shadow.
And what did he say?
He agreed. I mean, yeah. We went separate ways at a very early age. Our parents didn't, you know, the parents of twins make a mistake when they dress them alike. They didn't. My parents didn't do that. We had a separate identity from early on. So the confusion that people had about our identity made me want to establish it even more strongly and make it more obvious how different I was from Richard.
And are you very different? Because we've certainly all read those twin studies where twins are separated and they smoke the same cigarettes, they drink the same beer, they marry the same kind of women.
We're doing the same thing. Yeah. We write together and we're both teachers. But
right.
I devote more time to teaching than he does. There are ways that we're different that are subtle, but there are ways that we're the same that are amazing to me. He's a separate person. He's a different person. I mean, when I see a movie, I'm not sure if he's going to like it. When I hear a joke I think is real funny, I'm not sure he'll laugh at it. When we were younger, if I heard a joke that was funny, I knew he'd laugh at it. I knew it. Mm-hmm. And as we've gotten older, you know, we've developed and gone in different ways. My writing is different. I'm more didactic. I'm more conscious of what I'm writing about. And he's more unconscious, and his work, I think, is more artistic because of that.
Novelist Robert Bausch. His new novel is called Almighty Me. This is Fresh Air.